Welcome to this podcast of Sunday nights on ABC Local Radio. I hope you enjoyed the program.
Now for a change of pace. Islam in Australia is changing. The current generation of Australian Muslims are increasingly tertiary educated. And in the face of what sometimes can be confronting social hostility, we've just been talking about it, there are interesting stories, and Sahar Dandan is one such story. Sahar calls herself an accidental community worker, though she's been called far worse names, and sometimes by her own Muslim community. She's not alone, because women in migrant communities often are a cause for friction with established roles and traditions. Well, Sahar calls herself a child of civil war. At age six, snipers shot her best friend. Soldiers watched her town with loaded rifles. Through her community work, though, here in Australia, she's trying to stop the cycle of intergenerational angst that comes all too easily to those who've been fed on war. A chemical engineer by profession, Sahar now has the ear of our government and federal. She's active in many projects fostering social capital with the Lebanese Muslim Association. Her projects have attracted millions of dollars in funds. As a young mum, Sahar is faced with the challenge of communicating her ideas on social change not just to an Australian public, which sometimes aren't so trusting of Muslims, but she faces resistance within her own community sometimes. To begin, music here, a track of Sahar's choosing, Tracy Chapman, talking about a revolution.
Don't you know, talking about a revolution sounds. Don't you know, talking about a revolution sounds like a whisper. While they're standing in the welfare lines, crying at the doorsteps of those armies of salvation, wasting time in the unemployment lines, sitting around waiting for a promotion. Don't you know, talking about a revolution sounds. People gonna rise up and get their share. Poor people gonna rise up and take what's theirs. Don't you know you better run, 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 run. Oh, I said you better run. Talking about the revolution. Yes, finally the tables are starting to turn. Talking about a revolution. Oh no. Talking about a revolution. Oh, while they're standing in the welfare line, crying at the doorsteps of those armies of salvation, wasting time in the unemployment lines, sitting around waiting for. Don't you know, talking about a revolution sounds a whisper. And finally the tables are starting to turn, talking about a revolution. Yes, finally the tables are starting to turn, talking about a revolution. Oh no, talking about a revolution. Oh no, talking about a revolution.
Tracy Chapman there, choice of our guest in this hour, Sahar Dandan. Sahar, welcome to the program.
Thank you very much for having me.
Can we start with the Prime Minister? Because I think it's sort of interesting. When I was told some of your story, I heard that one day you were doing some community organisation and then suddenly you found yourself in the Prime Minister's dining room with Julia Gillard. What happened? How did you end up there?
There was a lunch meeting with Chris Bowen, Jason Clare and Tony Burke.
Hmm. In fact, I think it was Tony Burke who was the original conduit. You were chatting to him initially, wasn't it?
It was actually my brother that I chatted to first, and he said, you know what, I'm having lunch with these gentlemen. Why don't you come in and kind of just sort of give them a brief, a summary of your thoughts?
And they found a feisty Muslima.
So I walked in, and obviously they weren't expecting to see me. I had a really brief chat with them about some of the ideas that I had, and they sort of said, "Okay, yep, we're
come and talk to Julia."
Yeah, come and talk to Julia. And I really thought they were joking, you know, like this isn't going to happen. They're just saying that so that we get quiet. I remember seeing Jason at one of the Eid prayers leading on from that. I mean, this is a year in the making. Yeah. You know, it didn't just happen. Snap our fingers and it happened. And he said to me, "You have a meeting with the Prime Minister in 2 weeks' time. You need to prepare a much more in-depth proposal." And I said, "You're giving me 2 weeks. Can I extend it?" And he looked at me and laughed and said, "If the Prime Minister gives you 15 minutes, you don't say..."
"You'll be there."
Yeah. "You don't say, oh, hang on a second, I'm not free at that
Would
day.
Would Tuesday be all right instead?"
So literally we went and walked in, and I don't think she was expecting a female. That in itself...
Are you saying Julia Gillard is sexist?
No. I'm actually not saying that at all. What I am saying is, traditionally, the Muslim community would have probably had a Muslim representative.
Even if he was doing it on your behalf.
Even, yeah, exactly. Yeah. And so, and I remember walking in with my brother and everybody turned to him for the proposal, except he turned to me. And I remember Bob Carr was sitting to my left and I was like, okay, so here I am sitting in the dining room, which was padded, and I made an awkward joke about the padding and how many ministers might have gone crazy and that's why the room got padded.
That's exactly what I thought of when you said padded. But anyway, go on.
And I actually made that because my filter sometimes doesn't work. And so the thought popped into my head and went out my mouth, and some of them found it funny, thank God. When the actual focus was on a female representing this proposal and having my name on the proposal itself written by me, I think that in itself broke down some perceptions or misconceptions around the role that Muslim women play within the Muslim community.
Well, it did implicitly, because, I mean, how many Muslim prime ministers have been female? There's actually quite a lot when you look at it.
Yeah, there has been.
You're a chemical engineer by training, aren't you?
I'm a chemical engineer by profession, yes. When I had my third child, I decided to kind of leave full-time engineering.
When Miriam has born, this triggers a change.
This triggered a change. I wanted some time to kind of just focus on myself, my marriage and my children. And I wanted to homeschool because my eldest at the time was about six. At the time, my brother was heavily involved with the Lebanese Muslim Association. Yeah. And they sort of had very few resources that could, you know, write grants.
He's the leader of it at the moment, isn't he?
He is. He's the president.
That's right.
At the moment. Yeah, you might have seen his face around.
Indeed.
They say he's the good-looking one of the family.
He'll thank you for that.
So really I said, oh, okay, well, I've got some spare time up my sleeve. I'm happy to kind of volunteer some time to, you know, dabble in grant writing. So I started doing that back in 2009 at the LMA.
Perhaps we should talk about the Lebanese Muslim Association and what it does and some of that outreach. Because part of the reason you were talking to the Prime Minister was about these projects and was about what could be done to assist Muslim young people, to assist lots of things. Well, tell us, what are those projects about that you were running?
If I was to go back a step from that, having started as, you know, volunteering and then having a really interacting with the community, it becomes a kind of a full-time job. And so dealing with young people, dealing with community workers, dealing with and having sort of, you know, put myself in sort of the crucible of what's happening in the community, I started to recognise a lot of gaps that existed. Having some, I guess, transferable skills from engineering into community, I was able to kind of just do some, you know, what I call process modelling or root cause analysis to try and see where some of the gaps are for some of the problems that we're seeing.
Now, some of these had to do with
themselves.
Advocacy for youth, crisis interventions.
Yeah, I kind of covered a lot of territory, didn't I?
Substance abuse, grief and loss, mental health, homelessness, financial hardship, youth development, interfaith training. There's a huge range of things that the Lebanese Muslim Association are doing through stuff you're involved in.
There's a lot of gaps in the community. I'm not a social scientist. I always disclaim that. And a lot of the skills you get given in engineering are more problem-solving skills.
Yep.
So you get given a problem and it looks like this huge, gigantic problem and you've got to break it into chunks and say, okay, well, how am I going to work with this?
Chemical engineering, you're a scientist and you're an engineer.
It's actually, I have a double degree. I have a science engineering degree. I have a foot in each camp.
When we talk about the Lebanese Muslim Association, how many people do you reckon it touches in all of the work that it does?
That's a really good question. I mean, if you were to look at Eid prayers at Lakemba Mosque, that would give you an indication. You know, we get about, I would say, anywhere between 30,000 to 40,000 people that attend Wanji Road on that morning.
And I'm guessing they're not only Lebanese Muslims, there's a mixture.
Absolutely, yes. Mm. The Muslim community comes from over 70 ethnicities, so we'll get a variety of people from the African continent to Southeast Asia to the Middle East. And so we cover a lot of, I guess, global territory in terms of the ethnic backgrounds that come and attend Lakemba Mosque.
So your brother is the president of the Lebanese Muslim Association.
Yes.
You were working full-time in chemical engineering.
I was.
You're married to Anthony, an American too, by the way.
An American.
Three children. And you find that you move towards building social capital. Now, building those things, they're a bit, it's sort of nuanced social capital, isn't it? It's not formal things like schools and universities, but it is things like education. It is things like purposefulness.
Yep.
It is stuff like the value in society that's not only commercial. That's what it is, isn't it?
Yeah, it's more services. It's not infrastructure. I'm not looking in terms of capital expenditure, in terms of formulating assets. I'm looking at fostering human assets rather than actual physical assets.
Where did your feeling of urgency come from? What was it you were seeing? What were you coming up against?
This is the thing. We as a community talk a lot about doing stuff and recognizing, you know, a lot of, you'll talk to a lot of Muslims, the guy sitting in front of a cafe, and he'll tell you what the problems are. And I was getting frustrated by going to community consultations, going to government meetings, and coming back and saying, okay, well, we keep talking about the problems. You know, what are the solutions that I can create for the problems that are there? I like to put things into action. I like to kind of go, okay, yes, that's great. Now what do we do about it? How do we implement solutions? How do we solve the problem to what is occurring in the community? A lot of the things that I've written projects for, I'm the primary source that I look at because I'm a teenager that grew up on the North Shore of Sydney with a lot of issues that I faced growing up. As a teenager living amongst a community that was largely non-Muslim, recognizing that within myself in terms of, well, what things would I have liked to have been exposed to as someone growing up in Australia that now I need to create for other young people?
What were you missing in your teens?
Support, understanding for my own faith, being able to empower myself with tools to navigate, I guess, living in Australia. I was born in this country, so I was born in Sydney, but my parents decided to go back to Lebanon. So I spent my formative years of my childhood in Tripoli, in Lebanon.
What years are we talking about here? 70s, 80s? 80s? In the 1980s. That means, therefore, you were there at a time when civil war was still going.
Yes, probably the most inappropriate time to go back to Lebanon. But yes, I would call myself a child of civil war. You know, when I came back to Australia, I would say my English was very nominal. I literally was thrown into high school and having absolutely no understanding for how the school system in Australia works. Yeah, I've got some quite interesting memories of that time because, you know, I was in ESL class for most of year 7, year 8. I read almost every book in the library and moved from ESL class in year 8 to advanced English in year 9.
Were you in a state school, a private school, a girls' school?
I was at Willoughby Girls High School.
So it was a girls' school?
It was a girls' school, and girls tend to be quite nasty to each other.
Well, I'm an ex-teacher of girls, I've got to say. I taught 7 to 12.
Okay, how did you go with that?
The thing I did learn that in year 7, if you were identified as or the girls had decided you were an outsider, they could be absolutely relentless. They looked lovely, but if you actually listened to what they were doing to the one who'd been isolated, they could be really relentless.
Well, imagine the isolated kid as me in year 7, the girl that didn't have any friends. And if I did, it was the girls that were also isolated. So we had a group, less than a handful of girls in year 7 who were ostracized by the rest of the year for different reasons, whether it is we looked different or we couldn't speak the language. And it was a very difficult time for me.
Now, that brings us, I think, to the point of why you have gotten so involved in the various projects you've gotten into, doesn't it? Because we're talking about a generation of young people.
Mm.
And if you just take Lebanese Muslims, they've come to Australia largely because they have left a very unstable situation at home. Many of them got out of there to avoid war. That's why they came here. And there's all the adjustment that goes with that into a new society. And that's partly what you do, isn't it? It's helping people to belong. It's helping people to work out strategies for them to get ahead as well, I suppose.
A lot of the work that I try to do, I guess the way I look at it is empower people in the present to be able to navigate the future for themselves. Mm. And I think being a mother makes it all so much more pertinent for me because I want the future community for my children to look different to how it looks like right now.
Mm.
I want the perceptions of the Muslim community to change in this country. I want us to not be seen as the other. A lot of the work that I do, I see myself as trying to normalise the presence of the Muslim community in Australia. You know, words like indigenising our presence.
Mm.
How do we become part and parcel of the social fabric of Australia? And that's, I guess, for me, the ultimate goal is that if we espouse the virtues of multiculturalism yet not live it, I think we're doing ourselves a disservice as a country.
That whole idea of finding or an indigenous way, and by that you mean a way which is normal to Australia, Australian Islam, I suppose, is one another way I hear people talk about it. It sounded to me like you were not just talking about how Australia needs to change, you're also talking about the work you do inside the Muslim community, about self-perception, about the place young boys and girls are going to take in the world. So it's sort of a two-way process, it sounds like to me.
I mean, have a look at the demographics of the Australian Muslim community.
Mm-hmm.
I think over 60% are under the age of 40.
Mm.
We're a very young community.
Most born here now, I think.
Born here, mm-hmm. correct? And if you look at the statistics of young people entering tertiary education, it's actually higher than the average Australian stats in terms of more women, more young women and more young Muslim men and women are attending universities than the Australian average. So you've got to look at what's the Australian Muslim community going to look like in 10 years' time. It's mostly going to be second generation and third generation young professionals. And I feel like we're almost at a tipping point for the Australian Muslim community. We're going through, you know, what some scholars have called the baptism of fire.
Mm-hmm.
And we just happen to be at the centre of it right now, which is really difficult because you can't see the light at the end of the tunnel. But I have to believe that there is one because I think if we don't, we're not going to do the work that requires us to actually see a better Australia.
Mm-hmm. When you say we're in the middle of the fire, as it were, when you say that, that's also partly personal because I read an article, which I know you were not very keen on this article, but it said all sorts of things. You thought, oh, that doesn't need to go everywhere. But I read a nickname for you, AK-47. Now, here you are with your degree, wearing the scarf, three young girls, AK-47. And that was actually a term that was given to you because hothead elements in the community decided you weren't saying what they wanted you to say.
Yes, it came out of a community consultation, actually, where I raised some concerns over some things and some people took dislike to what I had to say.
Well, you were not being hardline enough, I think, was the point, wasn't it?
I think most people just assume that the way they see you should be the way that you are. And I think it comes as a shock to them that, yes, I am in hijab. Yes, I am a mother. I am female. But I also have the ability to articulate my opinions and my thoughts without cowering away or expressing them in a tone that is more acceptable to you.
Mm.
I will express them the way I think. And I remember at the time when they actually said that to me, I said, listen, this is very important for you to learn, is that you're not listening to the words that I said, you're listening to the voice that's saying those words.
Mm-hmm.
And I think you need to be able to differentiate that because if it was a male voice articulating the exact same thoughts, you would have said, what a powerhouse, rather than terming it as a
An AK-47.
An AK-47.
Well, it's interesting, isn't it? Because that nickname, AK-47, everybody thinks, oh, that means you're a revolutionary. But yeah. In fact, it was trying to say the opposite.
Yes.
They were trying to put you in your place.
Correct.
And saying, you're a woman, don't you talk to us like that, basically.
Correct. Yeah, basically. I mean, I've been called the Iron Lady. I wear that sometimes as a badge of honour because it means that I'm not going to be easily swayed by your opinions. And I think it's really important that once you formulate your values, that you're able to stand by them. And I think we're seeing way too many people that do an extreme swing, that pendulum swings all the time. There needs to be people in the community that say, this is who I am, and I'm quite comfortable with that person, and I am going to pursue what I need to pursue, regardless of the way you see what I do. And I get that a lot from the work that we are doing with the organization in terms of community work. Most of the negativity comes from my own community.
Mm.
And so it's very important that I believe in what I'm doing. I'm not claiming to be anybody that I'm not. I say very clearly I'm an engineer. I'm not a community worker. I call myself an accidental community worker.
Mm.
But I see that action needs to be done, and I'm not stopping anybody else from actioning what they feel needs to be done, but I'm doing what I believe I have to do.
Mm.
It's become a very passionate cause for me. You know, having a childhood that I would call not exactly fun and games, quite the opposite, and going through really difficult struggles as a child, you know, seeing the things that I see now, those things, I was that child going through those hardships, seeing those sights, those are a lot of my repressed memories.
What was the Tripoli like of your childhood? What do you remember? I mean, sights and smells. I often remember smells actually from cities. But what did you see? Where did you live? Were you in the suburb? Were you in the country?
I was actually in Bebte Beni. The apartment building that we lived in was opposite, it's called the Jabal Mahsin, which is the mount where the Syrian army kind of based. So a lot of the Assad regime was on a mount.
Looking at you.
Looking at us.
With guns pointed.
Constantly. I've woken up several times with windows shattered over us. You know, that memory of having to walk past bloodstains of where my best friend had been shot by a sniper as a six-year-old.
God.
That's difficult. And to imagine that other children are going through that right now. I mean, we're sitting here having this discussion.
Mm.
Yet we have no understanding of how lucky we are to be sitting discussing these things when people are just working to survive life.
Mm.
You know, like I'm talking about, working in the community and all of that sort of stuff. But I'm lucky to be here. I consider myself one of the lucky ones.
Well, I suppose that the question that it just sticks in my mind is, given you had that experience, you were there, you saw all this stuff.
Yeah.
Now you read of what has happened in the Middle East with ISIS. You read of what's going on, Sunni clerics killed for not being hardline enough, people under house arrest, children being mistreated and co-opted into war, all the things you hear about. And then you work in the community here. What do you bring to your community work in Australia that is affected by all that? And why has it made you so committed to what you do?
I've worked very hard to accept that the person that I am now has been built by the experiences that I've gone through. You know, my husband says to me that we lived in Mauritania, which is West Africa, in a tent for several months at a time. When we got married, he said, you know, after kind of sharing some of the stories, he said, I knew you could survive, because someone who's gone through that kind of childhood, you know, this is like having a cup of tea.
I suppose the thing that I want to ask is, we're sort of at a point in Australia at the moment where women just wearing the scarf out shopping are being bad-mouthed. So we've gotten to a point where we're on a terror alert. We know that terrible things are happening in the Middle East. But for you, I can't imagine that you'd want to see what you saw in your childhood ever be here.
Absolutely,
I can't imagine
not. I don't want to see it anywhere. And I think there's two things to this, is that we have to accept that there is some responsibility for what's happening in the Middle East,
mm-hmm.
that the Western countries need to accept some responsibility for that.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's what we're not seeing. We're not seeing that. I think a lot of young people feel that they don't have a voice in Australia. Young Muslim, whether it's males or females, and we're seeing an increase in female voices as well that are kind of becoming a little bit similar to the male, young male voices.
As in discontented, you mean?
Yeah, discontented, disenfranchised, marginalised. I mean, these are social issues that are not being addressed. And if they don't get addressed, you're going to be raising a generation that do not feel, first of all, like they belong. And I think if they don't feel like they're real stakeholders in the society that we live in, if they're not anchored and they're not accepted in the society, where are they going to go?
And those are those who are born here. I'm just highly aware also that, as you've been telling some of your story, I work with Franciscans in my parish where I go. And the Franciscans, of course, have parishes and connections all through Syria because that's where they serve Christian communities.
Yeah.
So I am, you know, one step removed from families who are under direct threat. You're one step away from families. There are families who are here now in the Muslim community, in the Iraqi Chaldean community, who have just left horror. They're just here. What can you offer for them in terms of social support and social capital that helps them to step away from what they've seen? And to work to be part of a happier and a broader society.
You know, I think what we first need to recognise is the Muslim community is very under-resourced.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we've been lucky in the last 12 months through a chain of events that led to some funding to run some projects.
Mm-hmm.
But I think you hit a pertinent point in talking about the horrors that people have seen.
Mm.
That trauma hasn't been dealt with. I think it's important that once we actually have these people amongst us, that trauma is dealt with, that mental health is focused on. But I think a lot of parents or children that have gone through that horror, there's no programs that address that. They're kind of thrown into the deep end in this country. And from my own personal experience, I think a lot of that is manifesting itself in the future generation, in their children or their grandchildren.
In disconnection, in alienation.
In disconnections, because subconsciously or consciously, that trauma is being passed on to these generations and no one's dealing with it. Because that, for me, is a root cause of some of the issues we're seeing, whether that's alcoholism, whether that's drug use, whether that's criminal activities that are occurring within the Muslim community.
Mm.
If we trace it back, we trace it back to traumatized parents who disengaged from their children for whatever reason, based on that trauma. And that disengagement from their children led to their children trying to find some kind of identity or some sense of belonging. And some kids ended up in the wrong crowd because they felt like, you know, whether it's a brotherhood or a sisterhood.
It's a remarkable thing, isn't it? Only a couple of weeks ago on this program, we had Munjid al-Madaris, who was an Iraqi refugee, who ended up spending 9 months in our detention centre in Curtin and then was thrown into high security prison as well. 9 long months after a terrible journey and a boat journey, having had his own life threatened in Iraq. Now, he's ended up a leading surgeon, but it could have gone another way.
It really is. You hear the good stories, but how many have gone through, we've lost through the system? And there's a lot. And I think most of it, if you look at those families, at the end of the day, they've come here for security. They've come here to be able to provide their kids with a better life.
Not to continue a war, quite the opposite.
Not to continue a war, exactly. Mm. They've come here so that they can ensure that there's food on the table, that there's clothes for their kids. And when they're not able to do that, or when they're being told that they don't belong here, that just adds to the problem. I think we're just kind of exaggerating the problem for them instead of trying and understand their situation and try and actually build resilience within those communities. And we're not doing that.
Let's just go back a step again. The Lebanese Muslim Association and the projects that you conduct through there. I'm aware, for example, back in the old days, 20, 30 years ago, when you were growing up in a Catholic family, if there was trouble in the family, if there were drugs appearing among a kid or there were serious problems at school or there was some sort of bad behaviour that was harming the child, you turned to the parish priest.
Yep.
And the same thing happens within the Muslim community, doesn't it? There's a lot of advice being sought from imams and from religious leaders. Now, that's in part why you've got these projects going, isn't it?
I've got one project that's specifically looking at that exact problem, is that, yes, the imams and the sheikhs are, fortunately or unfortunately in some cases, are the first port of call for most of the issues that families face.
And they're basically Quranic religious experts. They're not necessarily
they're
counsellors or psychologists.
Experts, and they're Quranic experts, not necessarily social or counselling experts or psychological experts. And as we're developing that expertise in the community, we don't take away the importance of the sheikh or imam as the first port of call, but the way I look at it is that they can be like my GP.
Referring, of course.
Yes, who's kind of like looking at it and kind of diagnosing the problem a little bit and saying, okay, well, I need to send you to a psychologist, or I need to send you to a family mediation center, or I need to send you this place. I need to send you to drug rehab.
Now, that is not dissimilar to what the training of a Catholic priest has been traditionally in this country. If you did your 6 years as a Catholic priest, you had to study psychology. You had to study crisis counselling. You had to work in drug and alcohol rehabilitation. You had to go to an old people's home. You had to teach in school. That was part of the training over the 6 years for a religious leader. And I wonder, is that part of the service you're sort of offering to imams and sheikhs?
We're actually at the moment almost done with development of a training manual that's specifically looking at training imams in, you know, accidental counsellor training, let's just put it that way, in terms of, okay, you can come in, you can, we'll give you enough tools to be able to diagnose it, but you need to refer them to the experts in that field. Something that was, I think, cleverly done is we made them think it was their idea.
It's always the best way to do it.
So even though the project was already written, we actually went and did a survey with them and said, okay, well, you know, what happens when you get these issues? You know, what kind of gaps do you think you have in addressing these things? And so we came back to them after we did this survey with several of them in Sydney and said, hey, we've taken your feedback. And we've implemented this project.
And it will then be developed even further, perhaps. And once it's established, you've got a starting point, haven't you?
You know, and that's exactly what's happened with the Engage Challenge Grow, which had 12 projects written under it. My biggest focus was about social cohesion. How do I develop positive civic participation in the people that I'm working with and in the participants of the programs? Because it was very important that I not only look internally, but I also look at how the internals are going to extend to the externals. So looking within the Muslim community, working outside the Muslim community.
You're talking about, when you say positive civic integration, you're talking about empowering teenagers who are told, go home, why are you wearing that? Where are you from? That sort of thing. Is it getting over that sort of sense of alienation and taking their place?
I think, yeah, it's about giving them anchorage within the society that they live in and saying, you know what, you can participate positively. And I think, because this community is relatively a young community, we've only been really, in terms of the migrant waves, most of the Muslim community has been here, let's say the Lebanese community in the 70s, I would say, but the others would be 80s and 90s, you know, the latest waves.
And when I look at it, I mean, I think the Lebanese would be the largest single Muslim community
we
here.
Are.
And then there would be...
Turkish.
Turkish would be the next big one.
Yeah.
And then there are actually quite a few Indonesians now. There are a lot of Iraqis now.
Yep.
There are lots of Persian Iranians here now.
Pakistanis
here now. Indians here now.
Correct.
It's huge. And 70 language groups. So there's a bit of a challenge even in coordinating internally with this stuff, isn't it?
It's very challenging. And so this is the difficulty, I think, that we face as a Muslim community, is that, first of all, Islam doesn't have a hierarchy. We don't have the Pope. It's really difficult when you talk about unifying the Muslim community or having a spokesperson for the Muslim community. You can't really assign one.
Maybe that's why you're so effective at what you do, though, because you pass things. In one sense, you can say ummah, and everybody will understand what the community is, the greater community of Islam.
Yeah.
But someone has to say, actually, what about this Pakistani or Urdu-speaking bit? What about this Indonesian-speaking bit? What about the young people? How do we deal with these sections of the big community? And that's sort of what you do, isn't it? You actually break it down.
Yes. So the way I looked at it was, I'm going to look at the Muslim community in age groups. Okay, let's say one of the projects is about the disengagement of parents at a young age from their kids, whether it's from their school community or from their local community. And the project was about building connections to that and empowering parents who might have some language barriers or who might have some other barriers to actually connect with their schools and to run events that they felt strongly about. For instance, we just went through a first aid course that the parents suggested we do. So a lot of it is about empowering the citizens of our country to be able to say, you know what, I had an idea and I've seen it to fruition, and there's nothing that gives you more satisfaction than seeing an idea grow into something and actually see it being implemented. And this is some of the unfortunate things around funding. And, you know, you might say $2.5 million, but that $2.5 million was only for 18 months. Mm-hmm. For me to implement 12 projects, I work 70 to 80 hours a week. Just ask my husband how often I'm home and my kids. But I feel the weight of my community on my shoulders, and that because this is the first time that this kind of funding has been given to the Muslim community in terms of doing grassroots community projects, the kind of pressure that I've put on myself to ensure the success of these projects is enormous, because
This is federal funding too, isn't
it? This is federal funding through the Department of Social Services. Mm.
This good relationship that you had with the Gillard government, it continues because you've still got good relations with the federal government. So it's something about what you're doing, I think, isn't it?
I think actions always speak a lot louder than words, and I think we've proven ourselves with the work that we've done. I've had non-Muslim organisations that I've partnered with or worked with that have told me categorically that the LMA in the last year has done more work than most other community organisations, full stop. Mm. We've worked very hard to implement a lot of initiatives, a lot of programs, and the momentum that we've developed, I feel right now that, you know, my own little project with my own staff, upskilling them to actually do work and making them passionate and committed to the community that we're working within, and to this cause that I am obsessed with, that one of my biggest stresses right now is seeing that come to an end. That would be devastating in a lot of ways, because to see, I know this is going to sound corny, to see the beauty of what we can achieve in such a short period of time. I mean, 12 months. It took us 6 months to just overcome some hurdles, a lot of hurdles from within the community and the misconceptions outside of the community about, you know, the work that we do. I take that as a collective team effort because we really believed in what we were doing. Mm. And that, like you were saying earlier, a lot of these projects have grown organically so beautifully. You know, like we're having National Mosque Open Day next week, even though that's been in the planning for over 12 months. It's a very timely project.
Mm. We've just been talking about it in the first hour, in fact.
And it's been a very timely project, linking that with also with Walk Together, which is formulating the National Day of Unity. I mean, everything's coming together so beautifully, I feel. It'd be devastating to see it end. But, you know, we're working very hard to try and say, okay, right now we have a lot of community intelligence. We've been working in this space. We've developed these partnerships. We've gone out and not only developed relationships and networks within the Muslim community and Muslim or other Muslim organizations, but we've also developed relationships with schools, relationships with other non-profit organizations, relationships with lots of government agencies, and it would be so difficult to come back to that momentum if we took a time out from it.
Sahar Dandan, accidental community worker. It's been fascinating to talk to you.
Thank you very much for having me.
This has been a podcast of Sunday Nights on ABC Local Radio. You can download your favourite Sunday night interviews from our website at abc.net.au/sundaynights with an S. Thank you for listening.